Michael Jordan was the first celebrity to have his own meal in 1992. And then McDonald's enlisted us and a couple other agencies to create a brainstorming task force. The first artist that was launched last September was Travis Scott with his own meal. And then we seeked out to see who was the next artist that needed to be true Latin. At the end of the day, we decided on J Balvin. If you really think about it, while J Balvin has crossover songs, all of his songs are in Spanish. He really, you know, has never steered away from who he is as an artist.
Very interesting.
And we told McDonald's, listen, this is who it needs to be and this is what it is. And we went on. We're very proud of it. I think probably one of the largest deals ever for a Latin artist, specifically for the
artist. Welcome to Latin Hitmakers, the Billboard podcast that tells the fascinating stories of the executives behind the greatest Latin artists and the hits that have been the soundtrack of our lives. I'm Leila Cobo. Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Hitmaker, and our guest today is Nelson Alvareda. Nelson is the CEO and founder of Loud and Live. So what is Loud and Live? Loud and Live is a quadruple threat, really. They have a concert promotion arm that promotes and produces the concerts of some of Latin music's biggest stars, including Ricardo Arjona, Carlos Vives, Camilo. It is a marketing arm. They were the company that negotiated the fable deal of J Balvin with McDonald's. And they are also a content production company through their newly minted Loud and Live Studios, for which they are up for a Latin Grammy for the Juan Luis Guerra documentary. And they are also an artist management arm to a lesser degree. And Alvareda is a serial entrepreneur. So this is your latest company, but your foray into music really started a long time ago, and it all started with a song. So Nelson, that is Kimbara by Celia Cruz. Why is this song so important to you?
Well, thank you for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure. This song is important to me because at the end of the day, I think, my roots, my parents are Cuban, Cuban-American. I had the great opportunity to work with her. And I think that Kimbara is just a song that resonates across anybody. And it really reflects the high energy that I think I have.
Well, you say you had the fortune of meeting Celia and working with her. Tell us a little bit about that, because you're Cuban-American, you're born here in Miami, we're in Miami, and it's not like Celia Cruz just kind of waltzes through your life every day.
So that the reason why I'm in the business is theoretically because of Celia. I was 18 years old and I had an idea, a marketing idea, that I took to Bacardi. And this was in the early 90s, and the idea was to create a big band, like a 1950s Cuban big band, and do what back then was branded entertainment, which was a branded CD. Cigars were not popular back then, and the whole concept was called Havana Nights. I went to Bacardi, I asked them for $35,000 for the idea, and it turned into a $2 million project. And at that point, we called a gentleman named Ralph Mercado, who was really, I think in many ways, an innovator, because he had a first 360, if you want to talk about it. He did the booking, he did the concerts, he had the label.
And let's do a parenthesis here for people that may not know who Ralph Mercado was. Ralph Mercado was this entrepreneur in New York, and he founded RMM Records, which was one of the seminal salsa labels.
Yeah, he was doing Jerry Masucci, if anybody knows who Jerry Masucci is, which was the founder of Fania. Mm-hmm. And when Jerry was the label, Ralph was a promoter, a street promoter, and eventually became a promoter of Fania. And then he really took salsa to another level.
He did sign Mark Anthony.
He signed La India. At a point, we had about 60 artists. Everybody that was anybody in salsa was there. So anyhow, we called Ralph Mercado for this concept, and another gentleman that worked with him named Bill Marin, who was pretty big. Another pioneer, San Marino Entertainment.
Oh my God.
He was a big promoter in the 80s and 90s. And Bill Marine met me, and I was 18. He goes, "Hey, kid, so tell me, what do you do?" And I said, "No, I was just starting.
What did you do?
I was just starting. I worked at a shoe company doing.
But you were going to college at the same
time?
Yeah,
I was going. I worked through college. I went to, ended up with UM, but I did an executive program at the University of Miami. And it was a night program or and weekends. And as a result, basically, I worked at a shoe company in an accounting department. In an accounting department.
Oh my God.
And I used to do on the side the marketing. I went to Bacardi. I took this idea. It became huge. They called Roth so that Celia Cruz and Tito Puente could be part of this project. And they ended up hiring me as their publicist. So I went to work, you know, at 18 years old. And imagine, you know, you're representing artists like Celia, Tito Puente, you know, Mark, La India, you name it. And that's how I met Celia and started working with her.
So before I get into how exactly you met Celia, I want to know how an 18-year-old kid just calls Bacardi and says, "Oh, I want to do this little, like, did you meet someone in the shoe company? Like, how
did you..." No, it's funny. So a lot of people don't know, but I was going to be a priest. So I actually went to the seminary. It was short.
No, Nils. This is news to me. But this is very interesting. So you went to the seminary. Okay.
Yeah, I started in high school a teen magazine, which is how I started. And the teen magazine was about pop culture, but all with values. So instead of, you know, how to make love to your man, it was just clean, nothing, you know, real churchy, but real good morals. It was a magazine called You that had grown a lot in the U.S. and I licensed it and I did a joint venture to do it for Latin America. This is like when I was 16, I was in high school. And then I decided to go to the seminary. That only lasted about 2 weeks. My first Saturday, the guys at the seminary took me out for pizza. It was a small town in Indiana. And the minute the pizza door opened, there was about 200 girls in the pizza shop. And I was like, "Hey, what is this?" And he said, "Well, the only thing in town is an all-girl boarding school." And I was like, "No." I woke up the next morning and I told the director, "Hey, I'm out. I can't do this." So anyhow, that's the story.
Oh, my God. Okay.
But I had met a guy through church that had some connections. And I told him, "Hey, if you get me into Bacardi, I'll give you 50% of whatever I make." And he knew the chairman of Bacardi in Bermuda. He called him up and we went in and we were two kids, really. So we had a group of like 20 old Cuban guys, because Bacardi at that point was still, most of the execs were old Cubans from Cuba. And they all were sitting there like they didn't want to pay attention to us. They were just there because the chairman had said, "Give these guys a meeting." And then literally 20 minutes into the meeting, everybody started like really waking up and they really got excited about the concept. And as a result, that's how I got into Bacardi. That's how I met Roth. And that's how I started working for Celia.
But through all of this, you didn't know Celia back then.
I did not know Celia. I didn't know Roth. I didn't know Celia. And if you fast forward, I got along great with Celia. The only other, you know, Roth was a black Dominican Puerto Rican. And the only other Cuban guy in the label was a guy who is Omar Pardillo, who became, you know, Omar was the publicist on the Northeast, and I was a publicist in the Southeast. And then
Omar is now one of your partners, one of your business partners.
So, yeah, so Omar worked at RMM, and then he left with Celia as management. And then I went on to radio, and then we teamed up after. I did a lot of shows with Celia. We did a lot of work with Celia. And then today we represent the Celia Cruz estate. So somehow Celia has always been part of my career for the last, you know, 20 something years.
So take me back, because Celia was such a formidable presence. Do you remember the exact day when you met her and what she told you?
Celia was very professional. And the first day that I met her, she said very cordial, mucho gusto. And she was always very sweet, but short. Like she would call me muchacho. And I think the thing that I remember her the most about, and I was new to the business, was that every artist was always late. They had, you know, they were running. And if we had an 8 o'clock press day at 7:45, Pedro and Celia were sitting there in the lobby. You know, you would be the one that would always be late. Even if you'd be punctual, they were already there ahead of time. So she was a very consummate professional, sweet and short, and very respectful. And another thing about her that was impressive also was that I'm sure was her personal notes. She would always send a handwritten note saying thank you for anything and for any little detail to anybody.
So this experience with Celia, with RMM, it sparked in you the desire to stay in music. Did you ever think, okay, I'm gonna do something else, I'm gonna have a career in,
No, you know, it woke up in me, you know, those were crazy times in the music business, specifically You know, I think salsa was the urban music of today, the same way that reggaeton is so hot. Salsa was it in the 90s. I mean, it was all over the place, and I thought, wow, you know, this is crazy. If these guys could do it, then I could definitely do it better. So as a kid there, I always thought, hey, I think I could do this better. I always had a big passion for marketing and doing things a little bit above what I think the music business was doing back then, which is why I decided then to really, I worked for a brief stunt right after RMM in an ad agency called Sanchez and Leviton, which at that point was one of the top three ad agencies, yeah. Hispanic. And then I went to work in radio. I worked in Hispanic broadcasting, which is today Univision. And that's really where I get then my start on the event side. Because mm-hmm. I started a group called Hispanic Marketing Group, and then I created all the radio events for Univision. So I had the opportunity to work with brands, to understand the power of radio, and to run the entertainment team at Univision. And that's where I really said, hey, you know, I think I could do this on my own. And I worked there until 02 and did that for 6 years. And then in 02, I left. I was the youngest manager at the time mm-hmm. in radio. And I left in 02 and decided to become an entrepreneur.
And that's when you launched Eventus.
No, so I launched a company called Unipro first that was general market focused on Hispanic. It did amazingly well. And as quickly as it rose, as quickly as it went down. We did a big event in December of 04 where we burned through about $2 million, $3 million in cash within 2 weeks. And I had put in about $1 million into the company and worked with my other two partners, and all of a sudden I had no money and I had to close the doors and I had to start again. I started Eventus in January of 05 with a dollar in my pocket out of the kitchen of my house.
Wow, so that must have been kind of a crushing blow, right?
I think I was depressed for maybe 2 months. And I don't know, I don't call it about depression. I think you learn from your falls. Mm-hmm. But it was very tough because I had not had a failure in my career until then. And also, you know, when you're at the bottom, you really understand who are your friends. I think prior to that, everybody in the industry, I was that kid, that golden kid, that everything I touched would be gold. And I remember specifically people calling me, hey, can I meet with you? Can I meet with you? And the minute I lost everything, the phone went dead. And I remember calling one specific person that wanted to meet with me, and she's like, you know, maybe I can do coffee in a month or two. I'm really busy. So it taught me really, it wasn't Leila, by the way, for the record. It was somebody else who didn't pick up my call. But, you know, it taught me that at the end of the day, it really was changing for me because I realized, you know, who's important around you, which I do believe it's family. Number two, that you do have, you know, a selected group of friends. But that really helped me because I was very focused at that point on building the business in Miami focus, because mm-hmm. I was just starting. And that made me really say, hey, you know, I want to do something national. It was 05, and I built a national company. And when the recession hit in 08, 09, I was in a good spot because I was working with national clients. If I would have been really regionally focused, I think I would have been in a tough spot. But yeah, I started Eventus. It was tough, but we, you know, I spoke to all the creditors that we owed money to. I personally paid for about 2 years, a lot of people back that wow. Had taken a hit. I called every single creditor and said, hey, whatever I can do, I will do it for you. Let me know what I need to do. I'll pay my share. And yeah, today, looking back at it, I don't regret it. It is part of who I am. I'm a man of my word, and that's the way we do business until today. And yeah, I started Eventus February 2 of 2005.
So right away. And Nelson, one thing that I've noticed in your story, it's always been a very 360 approach and an approach that incorporates marketing and branding into the music, which today seems normal, but really wasn't normal 20 years ago, was it? I want to say that this was actually very revolutionary because it wasn't like today where everyone's talking about Latin music and Latin music is a thing. Back then, Latin music was not anything.
The reason why I'm in this business is because of that concept that I took to Bacardi. It was pretty innovative for back then. I think that the edge has always been to show the difference when you incorporate brands authentically into music. It does work for consumers, and I think that that's what we do. And then really looking at it as how does it really work for the brand and for the artist, not just sticking a brand on there, not just doing an event to do an event, not just doing a sponsorship. I always tell artists, a lot of artists come to us or managers and say, oh, I want you to get me a sponsor. And I say, it doesn't work like that. When we work for the artist, we work for the artist. When we work for the brand, we work for the brand. And it's right when we find the right match is that it happens. Mm-hmm. I can't just go out and for a brand. And I think that's the key to making things happen.
I want to go back to your beginnings, but before I do that, now that we're talking about branding, one of the big branding deals that made a lot of noise last year and that I still use as a benchmark was the deal between J Balvin and McDonald's, where J Balvin had his own Happy Meal, which is something that's only happened to four artists in history. How did that happen?
You know, McDonald's is a client of ours. It's actually a client that I'm very proud of because it was really our first big client in 2006. McDonald's was the first client that believed in me and in our company, and as a result, a slew of brands came after working with us. So for McDonald's, the multicultural customer is an important segment of their business, and that includes Asian American, you know, African American, and Hispanic. It is a driving force for the business. And I think that it's important to call out that McDonald's has been a partner in Latin music since the 90s. I mean, we're talking about Enrique Iglesias' first tour they did, Alejandro Fernandez. They had a program during the 90s called Lo Máximo de la Música. So since the 80s, McDonald's has been involved with music consistent every year. Nevertheless, they wanted to do something very big different, and they wanted to use pop culture, Latin music, and really multicultural talent to really reflect who the brand is to general market customers. And they decided we're going to make a big bet. We're going to do something very different. And Michael Jordan was the first celebrity to have his own meal in 1992. And then McDonald's enlisted us and a couple other agencies to create a brainstorming task force. The first artist that was launched last September was Travis Scott with his own meal. And then we seeked out to see who was the next artist that needed to be true Latin. At the end of the day, we decided on J Balvin. If you really think about it, while J Balvin has crossover songs, all of his songs are in Spanish. He really, you know, has never steered away from who he is as an artist.
Very interesting.
And we told McDonald's, so listen, this is who it needs to be and this is what it is. And we went on. And it was, you know, it was a campaign that had a lot of money behind it. And we launched it first in general market, not even Hispanic. Mm-hmm. So I mean, this ran every major network, every major digital channel for general market during the NBA playoffs. And then it did really well. And then we launched a second round of the campaign, which was really targeting Hispanics during the Grammys. So I think we've done many deals. I think everybody continues to talk about the Balvin deal, and I think we're very proud of it. I think probably one of the largest deals ever for a Latin artist, specifically for the amount of time. It was a multi-million dollar deal.
Is there another deal you want to mention? Because you said you've done many deals.
No, I think right now we're doing great things with many clients. We just came out right now. Actually, it's launching as we speak right here today, where we're doing a series of episodes for Walmart, which is combining food and music. So it's called Celebrando con Sabor, and we have Chef Aaron, who's a big Mexican-American chef, and we're launching a series of episodes with Jay Quiles, with Carlos Rivera, with Natalia Jimenez, and they're real interesting segments, and it's a series of episodes.
So did you ever contemplate not doing your own business once you had that first company? Even
no.
When it plummeted, did you ever think, okay, I'm just going to go work again at Univision Radio and become the king of Univision Radio?
No, you know, I left Univision when I was 26, and I went on my own. And I promised my wife that I'd make $1 million by the age of 33. And that if I wouldn't make $1 million by the age of 33 and make it out, then I go back to corporate America. I don't think I made $1 million. Yeah, I think I do. I think I did make $1 million by 33. So I decided to stay on my own.
33, because that was the age Christ died? Is that why you chose 33?
100%. That's why it was. It was a magic number. I'm a big believer, obviously, as you know. So I said, hey, 33, that's the number.
Now you're like this huge established figure. We are in this building that bears the Loud and Live name, by the way. So it's this tall building, Loud and Live. It has, you know, two floors. But it's, you know, there's a bank here, but it's your building. But back then, you get married, and what does your wife say about this crazy guy trying all these things? Like, did she believe in you, or was she like, oh my God?
She always believed in me, and everything was never rosy. We always laughed that she used to cut coupons to save some money at the grocery store. So always hardworking, but you know, she was really always supportive. She never not believed in me.
I was speaking with a manager the other day that told me that the artists that have success do so because they have a chip on their shoulder or they have something to prove. Is that the same thing with you and your desire to create your own company from a very young age?
Listen, to me, money is not important. And I think a lot of people think it is, but it's not. To me, it's you know, the money is obviously the prize of the success, but what I care about is success. And I think that I've always wanted to build something and always look at it the next step. When I did Aventus, I decided, you know, halfway through it that I didn't have necessarily the capital to be a big player on the entertainment side. So Aventus had, you know, the IP side, all the stuff that we worked with, Grammys and Premio Juventud. We had the brand side, and then we were a promoter.
Aventus was your company prior to Loud and Live, and it was a wonderful multi-layered company. You had a podcast back then. Well, they weren't called podcasts, yeah. But there was just a lot going on. There was a lot of content production as well as event production.
Yeah, Aventus was very successful. That's a company that I started prior to Loud and Live in the kitchen table of my house. And I started that in 2005. And we built it quickly in 8 years. We sold it in 2013 to part of a private equity group. And I think that that's where that company was really known for multiple things and for being innovative. I mean, if you think about it, you know, doing festivals around the Latin Grammys and commanding the money that we used to command from sponsors and everything at that time, I think everything was innovative. The promoter arm on the live entertainment side really was regional. And then I decided at some point, hey, you know, I don't necessarily have the capital to beat, you know, competitors right now in that space. So I said, let me focus it more on the brands. And we were successful. We became we became the largest brand activation, you know, music marketing, sports marketing company in the U.S., which is why we sold it in 2013. And I think that what you see with Loud and Live is really a recollection of all the experience that I had in the past. And I think our runway is huge. And it's the combination of content in my past, the marketing with the brands, and then live events and the entire concert promoting world. And then adding on that sports, which, you know, we're very big in the CrossFit space. We're probably the largest CrossFit player right now outside of CrossFit. We own 5 festivals, one in Spain, one in Mexico, and the top 3 in the U.S.
Nelson, how important, when people think about Loud and Live, people that are not familiar with your story, the first thing they think about is concert promotion, because you're doing so many concerts right now, especially since the pandemic, quite frankly. How important has that become for you? And I'll rattle off a few of the artists. Carlos Vives, who's a huge name. Ricardo Arjona, who's a huge name. Then you have a bunch of up-and-comers like Camilo, who has a sold-out tour, very exciting artist. Then you have Farruko. I mean, you have like 30 concerts that you're promoting in the next, 30 different artists.
Yes, that's correct. Our approach is a little different than other promoters. We like to work with the artists 365 days a year. So I'll give you a perfect example. With Camilo, you know, before he blew up on the scene, we had said, hey, we're going to do showcases with you. We will pay for those showcases. Let's do a showcase in Houston. Let's do a showcase in LA. Let's figure out what, you know, the consumer wants or the trends. How can we help you with your marketing? So our approach is really partnering with management, partnering with the labels, and partnering with the artists year-round. So there's what we call a Loud and Live difference, which is a set of internal rules that we follow.
Really?
Yeah, there is. We call it the Loud and Live difference. How do we?
Did you actually sit down and write this?
Yep. This was part of, you know, we have core values, and part of our core values is a couple of them is, you know, stay authentic, be passionate, integrity, fun and crazy is healthy. Timing is everything. Whether you get in an offer at 5 o'clock or you get in at 5:30, it can mean the big difference.
So you always pick up the phone?
Always, always. And I firmly believe that. I have lost deals for not being on time, even though I try to, because one day early can make all the difference. We recently lost a deal, and it was because If we would have closed it the day before, it would have been very different than the day after. So
I agree with you.
And one of our core values too is ABC, always be closing.
Always be closing?
Yep.
Now, like I said before, Latin and Latin music and Latin culture are like hip now. But you had to power through, right, Nelson? I think that you did a big job in opening the door for a lot of people that...
Oh, listen, we've been through the ringer. Latin music has not always been easy to sell. I have many stories. I'll tell you a quick one. Dr. Pepper, Snapple Group was a big client of ours. And I remember them coming to us, I don't know, it was probably 09, and saying to me, hey, we want to find somebody that's authentic with, you know, Latin, let's just say teenagers back then. And we said, look, we have a good guy, his name is Pitbull. Pitbull back then had that song that was popular that said culo, which is negative word to some. And
Sounds so quaint now.
I know. Well, that was a huge problem back then. These group of, let's just say, white marketers sitting in Plano, Texas said, they fought with me. And they're like, this is crazy. How could we do something with this? And I said, look, you're asking me what's right for you. I'm telling you, this is what's right. Long story short, 3 months back, they did their research and they came back and they said, hey, let's do it. And at that point, it was innovative. It started as a Hispanic campaign, and then eventually Pitbull became part of college football and general market for Dr. Pepper. But I think brands have always known there's something there, but it has not been easy. There hasn't been the money that there is today. And I think to a certain degree, I think a lot of people do not discuss this, but I don't have a problem discussing it, which is, you know, today's social justice, discrimination, but in a lot of the brands in corporate America, even me, I mean, I was born in the US, I'm American, but I have an accent because I live in Miami. And we've never been allowed many times to do even general market work. It's been like, well, you're Hispanic, so you can only stick to your Hispanic box.
And you have a different Hispanic budget.
Yeah, and there's different brands that have believed more in Hispanic, but yeah, there's been discrimination out there. A lot of brands in the past, I think, spoke and they didn't really, you know, mean what they said. It was just a check the box type thing. I think today we're in a unique situation, which the power of the market, the power that Latin music is not just more for Latins, right? You got every Gen Z kid, whether they're white, black, Hispanic, Indian, they're probably listening at some point to a Bad Bunny or a certain artist. And there's a huge, huge opportunity. And I think it's a very different marketplace today. I think what we need to do as an industry on the Latin side is continue to push integrity, ethics, and ROI. How does this ultimately work?
Is there a mistake being made now in the market you find with Latin? I get bombarded with so many press releases and so much information and stuff going on from people that I feel don't really know the market. Does it matter? And is that what you feel too? Or on the contrary, you think that people are making a great effort to educate themselves?
No, I do think that the business, slowly people are trying to educate themselves. I do think that the entire industry is trying to raise the bar. Mm-hmm. You know, the conversations that you have today with artists, with managers, with brands, with promoters, there's still a lot of work to do. I think that that's also part of the business. But I think that, no, I think people are trying to raise the bar.
Mm-hmm. So that's great. So we're at a good moment. We're at a little dawn of renaissance.
I do agree that that is true.
All right. So... what is next for Loud and Live in the between now and the end of the year?
Yeah. No, I think, you know, we have about 300 shows over the next 6 to 7 months. Mm-hmm. It will be critical expansion time for us. It's easy when you do 60, 80, 100 shows. When you take that exponential growth, is significant. We are also in the process of launching in the next 6 months, a media platform that will live on social media channels as well as on SiriusXM. Mm-hmm. That will be called En Vivo. And the idea is that we can tailor all the content, not just from artists that we work with, but from all the shows, go live from all the shows and really create a platform that can create video and audio content. And how do we leverage that? Working on a couple more content deals with the HBOs, Amazon, and Netflix of the world, and continue to grow that division. And then taking, you know, we do want to be a global player, not just U.S. Right now, we're currently active Puerto Rico, U.S., and Canada. I think you'll start hearing more and more us expanding into other territories outside the U.S. And also continuing to add star talent. So we will continue to be a magnet for talent. That's all we have. And it's been hard. If I can say something to anybody in the industry, is for executives to continue to raise the bar, be ethical, integrity, passion. This is about passion. You got to believe in people. You got to believe in artists. And I see it. There's projects, when you do projects with passion, they work. I think you said that about the artists that have a chip on their shoulder. I don't think it's about having a chip. It's about wanting something and not stopping until you get it.
So, this is what I like to call our rapid questions.
Okay.
Which change with every individual.
Can't wait. Shoot.
So you're promoting all these. You're doing over 30 artists. But you started with Celia Cruz, so I want to know, what are the three must-have songs that you have on your playlist?
I have Kimbra from Celia. I have Ya Viene Llegando of Willy Chirino, which was very important to me because of my background. And then I think the third song, that's a tough one, the third song would be a recent song that I just, Que Se Vayan Ya, which is a song that I produced, so I'm a little bit biased. My whole thing with Cuba has nothing to do with politics, it has to do about human rights. Mm-hmm. I'm a big human rights believer anywhere in the world. And I was able to bring together Willy Chirino, which is, yesterday's and today's iconic, let's just say, Cuban singer with always has spoken very hard to his line on messaging for human rights.
Very outspoken and very consistent.
Yeah, and I had called him up when this whole thing happened in July with everything that we saw, which, big shout out to Yotuel and Gente de Zona with that Patria Vida song, because I definitely think that they did an amazing job and started a movement. I was able to bring together about six young artists. And so I brought Lenier, Señorita Diana, El Micha, El Chacal, and Osmani mm-hmm. Garcia to produce a song with Willy.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. Listen, I think it's just, this is the first time that the global community has really realized the issue of Cuba, which at the end of the day, again, not politics, it's leaving that outside as human rights. And
okay, so what are you afraid of?
I'm not scared of flying, which is interesting. I was, but I'm not. But I'm petrified of heights. I cannot even go, if I go on a balcony, I need to be like three steps back. And that is true, I am petrified of heights.
What do you spend too much money on?
I love boating, I love the water, it's my only place where I can really relax. So I spend a lot of money on the water.
What did you buy when you got your first significant check?
I think the only thing that I bet was that when I would sell my first company, I'd go and I'd buy a Ferrari, which was a huge mistake. But I went and actually, I showed up in Vegas. And there was a Ferrari dealership at the Wynn, and I walked into the dealer and I offered the guy a check to take a Ferrari delivery right there in Vegas. And the guy didn't take me serious, so I said, yeah, forget about it. I ended up buying a Ferrari in Miami, and really, in reality, I sold it about a year later. It was just something that I had promised myself that I would do when I would sell the first company. But I'm impulsive, not when I get a check, I'm impulsive every day.
And finally, what's your perfect day off? When you have a day off, what do you do?
A perfect day would be to spend it out with either friends or my family on the water. But that's hard for me because I definitely take very little days, and even when I am on the water, I'm always working.
And you gotta pick up that phone no matter when or where that call comes in, right?
It's a personal thing that I believe in. Not picking up that phone could make you lose a deal. So I'm always on, which I think is a very good thing, and this also brings some negatives around with it.
Does your wife ever make you leave the phone at home?
It's a constant battle.
Nelson, thank you so much for being with us here in Latin Hitmaker, the podcast that tells the story of the fascinating executives behind the hits. And we will see you again next week.
Thank you very much, Lila.